You're listening to New Retirement Radio, brought to you by the team at Prout Financial Design.
Hello, I'm your host, Certified Financial Planner Dennis Prout.
I'm Heidi Cartwright, Financial Advisor and RICP.
I'm Deanne Jennings, and I'm here to share data and dive into the world of finance with you.
Advisors associated with Prout Financial Design may be either 1, registered representatives with and securities offered through LPL Financial, member FINRA SIPC, and investment advisor representatives of CG Advisory Services, a registered investment advisor, or 2, solely investment advisor representatives of CG Advisory Services, a registered investment advisor, and not affiliated with LPL Financial. Investment advice offered through CG Advisory Services, a registered investment advisor, CG Advisory Services, and Prout Financial Design are separate entities from LPL Financial. Dennis Prout and Nathan Prout are solely investment advisor representatives of CG Advisory Services and are not affiliated with LPL Financial. The opinions voiced in this show program are for general information only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. To determine which strategies or investments may be suitable for you, consult the appropriately qualified professional before making a decision.
WTCM News Talk 580, the theme music of New Retirement Radio with Prout Financial Design in Traverse City with Mr. Dennis Prout. Good morning, sir.
Well, it is so good to be in, Ron, on 10/31, Halloween, baby.
Ooh, so
all of us can go out and get some more chocolate, candy, sweets. Trick or treat. Sorry, you're too old. You can't do this, sir. Yeah. I just trying to, you know, picture myself going door to door trick or treating.
Just take the grandkids; you'll be fine.
Ah, I like it. They'll be the cover. Yeah. We had the coolest Halloween downstate in Farmington, with our son, his wife, and 3 boys wandering through the neighborhood, and they had Halloween on Saturday. So All the folks are out there sitting at their tables with their candy out there, and the adults were all going through the we're all talking amongst, you know, each other, if you will. It was a phenomenal time. I thought it was the best Halloween ever.
The adults taking some of the candy as
well?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, they offered it to me, but I just said no. I feel too guilty doing that. But
so somebody said today it was like early voting. It was early trick-or-treating.
Yes. It just lasts
like
forever
that.
Now.
Yeah. I like that.
The kids came up with
not nearly so pressured, you know. Well, we have, you probably heard, we have Heidi Cartwright, our own RICP, joining us today. Good morning, Heidi.
You do. Happy Halloween to everyone out there.
Yes.
I hope it's a great day for everyone.
Yes, I do too. And Deanne Jennings, welcome, our Director of Operations.
Good morning to everyone. Thank you for joining us and listening in this morning.
This almost seems surreal, that we're on the radio. It's just, you know, crazy. Here we are again on Thursday. We've been here about 23 years or so.
No way.
Yeah, not 23. Why did I say 23?
Why
did
you say 23?
About 20. Mm-hmm. 20.
About 20. Well, still, that's a long time.
We're exaggerating.
Something like that. Yes, exaggerating. Yeah. He's always exaggerating. And we are not going to talk about politics except to say the world is not going to end. The world is not going to end. I actually have a great article here from the Wall Street Journal I thought would be helpful in terms of maybe a little perspective. By the way, if people do have a financial question, Ron, regardless of financial nature and or something that we might be able to help, they can either text or call, and that number is, if you would, please.
231 area code, 947-0023, 947-0023.
Awesome. The election will end, the world won't, is the name of this article.
Ah, yes.
So both sides, by the way, this is written by Matthew Hennessy for the Wall Street Journal. Both sides are treating this election as a potential apocalypse. Can you say that 3 times? Everything is on the line. The party is over for good if the wrong party wins. But is it in the American experiment really? Is the American experiment really so close to the edge? not from where I'm sitting. If you zoom out, and I mean way out, things are going pretty well in the land of the free and the home of the brave. We are on the cusp of our 250th birthday. We still have our Republican form of government, our Constitution, Bill of Rights, despite some close calls. Roughly 2% of the population lost their lives in the Civil War, the equivalent of about 6.5 million people today. In the 20th century, we made it through two world wars, a Great Depression, the assassination of two presidents, and the resignation of another, the trauma of Vietnam and the fall of communism. Even after all that, we stood tall as the world's sole superpower. September 11, 2001 didn't kill us. Neither did the housing collapse nor the financial crisis. We beat COVID. We even survived the ugly... Never mind, he talks specifically. The U.S. boasts an innovative and resilient economy that is the envy of the world. And I write in there, still. S-T-I-L-L. Still. We live longer and better than our grandparents did. Our universities and companies are magnets for global talent. We invented the telephone, the airplane, the automobile, and the internet. Mm-hmm. We invented the internet, yes. Okay, I'll move on from that comment. We're given the world jazz, we've given the world jazz, rock and roll, and hip-hop.
Hello.
Yes. We have Hollywood and Silicon Valley. Wall Street is still top dog. The dollar is, believe it or not, still the world's reserve currency, and U.S. treasuries are the world's safest investment. Even Warren Buffett holds more than the U.S. government itself in short-term treasuries.
Wow.
And he is Mr. Safety. So I thought that that was helpful on this morning for perspective, yep. Given our own all. And I'm included in that deep dive into the politics of the world today. Shapers. I mean, that's the first thing I read in the morning, you know, what's going on. So perspective.
Perspective.
Hope that's helpful. And an encouragement, maybe, even to you and to me. So today we're talking about the top 23 questions that financial advisors have asked us. This is from a conference that Ed Slott sponsored back in September. Now, Heidi's going to be talking about the new 327 rule for spousal beneficiaries. That means you were married and he or she died. That's what that means.
And okay? You're the beneficiary.
And you're mm-hmm. the beneficiary. You're named as the beneficiary. Thank you very much.
Clarification.
Yes. Right. And then Deanne has some rock and roll stats this morning on what's going on with AI.
Absolutely.
And the power demands that they're looking at mm-hmm. and some of the other old-fashioned metals that they're using in the process of that generation of power.
Yes.
Okay. So in mid-September, Ed Slott and company virtually hosted another successful IRA training workshop. We simultaneously monitored the live Q&A stream and answered over 250 questions from our attendees, from everyone from Hawaii on up. Through programs like this, we learned firsthand that what areas are most problematic for advisors. I thought this would be, you know, titillating, edge-of-the-seat sort of stuff. Yes. In this issue, we are bringing the top 23 questions. I'm not going to ask all 23. I thought about five if we can get to them. We'll give it a shot. We'll give it a shot here as I turn the page.
There's a top 23 that financial advisors like you have asked Ed Slott?
Ed Slott in the most recent, most recent until Heidi just attended the one out in, where was that at, by the way?
La Jolla.
La Jolla.
La Jolla.
Not La Chaim, La Jolla.
Or La Jolla, as some people say.
Yes, if you went just with the pronunciation.
Just as long as you don't say La Jolly, right?
La Jolla.
Question number three. If a Roth IRA owner dies before the five-year holding period, so there's a five-year holding period for gains for you to take it out free of tax. Before the five-year holding period for qualified distributions of earnings is satisfied, does the beneficiary, so the person has passed away, the owner has passed away, start a new five-year holding period? Answer, the beneficiary does not start a new five-year holding period. Instead, the beneficiary must wait out the original owner's clock, So he or she owned that IRA, Roth IRA, for 3 years. It's two more years to take the gains out free. This is true even if the beneficiary has his or her own Roth IRA. Okay. A spouse beneficiary, however, who does a spousal rollover can use whichever holding period is most beneficial.
Yeah, so this is sort of curious because you as the beneficiary have to find out when that Roth was open.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So. Was it open sooner or later versus your own IRA, Roth IRA? And which is the better holding period for you? That's why you need a financial advisor when inheriting these sorts of things. Make sure you get advice. I mean, really, in this 327 thing that we're going to get with Heidi going on, we now have a table we're going to use for spousal beneficiaries because it's that complex. Mm-hmm. And Heidi's holding it up. Do you see that, Ron?
I see that graph table box thing.
It's crazy.
Lots of boxes. Mm-hmm.
Complex.
That means lots of choices.
Yes. So a spouse beneficiary who does a spousal rollover can use whichever holding period is most beneficial. So just be aware. Am I using his in case, you know, she's surviving him in this case? Or do I use my own, given it's a Roth IRA conversion or transfer to your own, given that he passed away in this instance? Four, do inherited Roth IRAs have RMDs? The inherited Roth IRA must be emptied by the end of the 10th year following the year the IRA owner died. So again, you're an inheritor. If the funds are not needed, it makes sense to keep them in the inherited Roth IRA until the end of the 10 years in order to maximize tax-free accumulation. And then the following question in number five is, why in the world would the IRS require inherited Roth IRA accounts? Again, you're the survivor of a Roth IRA owner, to be drained in 10 years when there is no tax due on these distributions. Money. It's always about money. The IRS wants to get Roth IRA dollars back into circulation as soon as possible so they can generate new tax revenue. Hence, the 10-year rule applies to inherited Roth IRAs for non-eligible designated beneficiaries. That's someone who's generally 10 years younger than the IRA or a non-spouse beneficiary. So you're a spouse. Again, you can inherit your spouse's Roth IRA, and you're not subject to these tight rules and regulations.
You're not subject to the 10-year rule?
You're not subject to the 10-year rule.
Spouses are special. Mm-hmm. They're treated totally different than anybody else. Yep. They have extra options. So if you're a spouse, you really need to think about what choices you're going to make, and that's some of the stuff I'll go over.
What was the point, though? You said that they want to get these tax dollars, they want to get the dollars back into circulation so they're spent and generate new tax revenue. That was
for who? Because it can't. That's for a non-eligible. Let's say you inherit your father's Roth IRA. You're a child, in this case, of the owner. And let's say in that Roth IRA you got $100,000. A Roth beneficiary IRA. It's your dad's, okay? He just passed away, assuming you're the beneficiary here. Well, you inherit that. You have to empty it over a 10-year period. Now, the reason they want it emptied, or after the end of the 10th year, is because then that money will be taxable as it earns interest and so forth. In the Roth IRA, it's non-taxable. There's no tax.
Right, so it becomes what we call non-qualified money, or I like to call it regular money. So it would just go in, if you kept it invested, it would go into an individual or a joint account, and you would be taxed annually on all the gains and interest and dividends that you receive.
But if you get $100,000, you've got to spend it all in 10 years.
You have to empty it after the end of the 10th year. You don't have to spend it over the 10-year period. You can leave it in there as long as you like.
But as you take it out, or whenever you take it out, it's taxed?
No, it's not taxed. It's not taxable. But when you pull it out and put it into another account, let's say you and your current spouse, a joint account that you hold between you and a spouse, okay, outside of the Roth, then you pay tax on the dividends, albeit at a maximum 20% rate. It's still significantly beneficial for you to get dividends in capital gains.
What if you just spend it? What if you just say, I've got an extra 10 grand a year I'm going to spend from Dad's IRA.
I'm sorry, I'm a financial advisor. That doesn't equate you. You said what again?
What?
No, but spent it?
Yeah. You're going to spend it. You got to put it into college, kids' college or whatever.
Yes.
So you don't, on withdrawing it, you don't pay tax. But once you start spending it, it's going to generate tax revenue, isn't it? Because it's out in the economy.
Possibly, unless you gift it. If you gift it for a grandchild's college education, it's not taxable at that point. Or if you decide to gift it to them, period, they pay tax at their rates.
Or you could give it to charity.
You could give it to charity as well. Well, it might not be deductible at that point. See how complicated this is? I think I need a financial advisor. Yeah, that and some aspirin, right?
So that was the third one of your three most, one of the most common questions asked of Ed Slott by financial advisors.
Yeah.
Yes.
Here's another. If a rollover check from an inherited IRA, so again, we're speaking your father again has treated you as you're a beneficiary, from an inherited IRA is made payable to you in this case, not the custodian. Is that considered a 60-day rollover or indirect rollover? Let's say you get the check. It's made payable to you, Ron. Can you do a rollover? The answer is?
You mean put it into one of my accounts? Rollover? What do you mean by that?
If you got the check made payable to you, can you consider that a 60-day rollover and not pay the tax on it?
Maybe.
No.
the smart money's on maybe.
There you go.
Sounds like the election.
It often is the answer, but not in this case.
Yes and no.
In this case. The answer, two letters right there. It says no. Okay, I cheated. It says no. No, a check made payable to a non-spouse beneficiary would be considered a distribution because a non-spouse beneficiary can never do a 60-day rollover. So you inherited from dad or mom, let's say. That's usually the case. Beneficiary IRA, then that's what that's called. You have to transfer it direct to the custodian as a beneficiary IRA to avoid the tax and any penalties that might have accrued on that. So that's how to do that. Last question. I think we've got time for one more, do we not?
Yes, we do.
Okay, great. If you are working past age 70 and a half and contributing to your 401k, can you still do a qualified charitable distribution from your IRA?
Say that again.
So if you're still working past age 70 and a half, let's say you're 75 and contributing to your 401k, so you're still having some money come out of your income and going to your 401k, can you still do a QCD or qualified charitable distribution from your IRA? The answer is
yes.
Good.
Ding, 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 ding. Good job.
Wins the prize.
You can still do a tax-free QCD or qualified charitable distribution from the IRA. And it doesn't, that contribution that's being made to the 401k, totally unseen by the IRS. Unseen, unheard, unknown. But you may have to take, if you're still participating, you won't have to take RMDs at all unless you're more than a minor owner in that company that sponsors that 401k. So there's some interesting things. Now, you can't do this if you have an IRA. You want to make contributions to an IRA? Do not make them to a regular IRA and do a QCD. That's where you get into trouble. Do those contributions to only Roth IRAs. If you have earned income after age, today it's 73, in almost every case, make your contribution to the Roth IRA account. Rather, if you're going to do QCDs at all, because you really gum up the works if you do that. And I think that'll be enough detail. Again, if you have questions of a financial nature that we might be able to help answer.
You can text those to us. Run. You can call those to us, 947-0023.
Awesome. So, Heidi.
Yes.
The new 327 rule for spousal beneficiaries. Again, you're married, your spouse passed away, you are usually primary beneficiary. What happens then?
Yes. So this comes from the class I just attended last week with Ed Slott, the Master Elite Group, which is, there was about over 300 financial advisors at the class, and he brought us up on the new regulations that were announced in July this year, which were commentaries on the Secure 2.0 law that went through in 2022. So this is, the IRS is just now coming out with, how do you interpret these laws and how, what are the rules associated with those new provisions?
So these got much more complex, but they also, in some cases, really opened up some more options for spousal beneficiaries. Now, it's key that you understand these options, because they could make a significant difference to you, given that you just experienced the worst, a spouse passing away before 59 and a half or after, and I guess it doesn't matter in that respect, but especially if you're younger, these rules can really help in some situations.
Right, so I'm going to give you just a basic outline, high level here, but just so that you can understand some of the complexities that are involved for spousal beneficiaries, and this is going to be for people who inherit, spouses who inherit in 2024 and later years. So if it was prior years, the rules you may be following may be different, because this is new legislation, so it's from 2024 on.
January 1 of 2024?
Mm-hmm.
All right.
All right, so there's three basic options if you inherit an IRA from your spouse.
And one doesn't count. All right. So
that would leave two.
But it's still an option. I mean, they still have it in the legislation. Mm-hmm. So the first option is called a spousal rollover. So only a spouse beneficiary can
sounds like something that could get you in trouble.
Yeah, it sort of does, actually, if you think of it in a certain way, can do a spousal rollover of an inherited IRA into their own IRA. So you can actually take the funds and do a trustee-to-trustee transfer and move those assets from your spouse's IRA into your own IRA. And there is no deadline for a spousal rollover, meaning if you don't do it right away, you can do it at any time. If the spouse chooses the rollover, the IRA will be treated as the spouse's beneficiary's own IRA. If a spouse rollover is done via a 60-day rollover, any RMDs due for the year must be taken before the rollover is permitted. However, if a spouse rollover is done by direct or trustee-to-trustee transfer, the RMDs can be taken later in the year. So what
if an RMD was required at that point?
If one's required, if you're going to do a 60-day rollover, which is when, like Dennis mentioned earlier, you get the check in the mail and your name is on that check and it's not made out to a custodian, and you have 60 days to get that into your own IRA, you must net out that RMD required. You can't roll it over. But if you do a trustee-to-trustee transfer, that means it's all electronic or the check is made out to the custodian, then the RMD that was required for the spouse that passed away can be taken out any time during the rest of the year.
There's no limit. You can do the whole amount of that IRA from your spouse into yours.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah, why would you ever not want to do that, Heidi? I mean, let's just ask that question right off the get-go. Why would a spouse not want to do a direct rollover to their own IRA?
Well, one of the major reasons why, and this is probably the reason we see the most often, is if the spouse who is remaining, the alive spouse, is under 59 and a half, and you move funds into your own IRA, you are following the rules for yourself, and you are not allowed to take money out of an IRA without a 10% penalty prior to 59 and a half.
So this would be, if you don't want to follow the rules for your own IRA, this would, could be an opportunity to say, what are my other options?
So then let's move on to option two. So option two is to treat the IRA as the spouse's own. That means you just leave it. You just leave it in the name of the spouse who's passed away. And you can just treat it like it's like, you know, you would be the beneficiary, but it's still going to be in the name of the person who passed away.
And this is the one that we don't really want to choose because most custodians don't like it. And this is the one I think we just ought to move beyond because it's not really that helpful or available.
Right. And custodians themselves, so where your IRA may be, they, a lot of times, they will not allow you to do this option because they don't like having an IRA in the name of someone who isn't living. So
Dead people can't have IRAs. That's the problem there, Ron. Mm-hmm.
So this option is there, but I've never seen it used. In maybe a very specific circumstance, it could be beneficial, but that would be very, very unusual.
Yeah, we actually called Ed Slott this morning before the show to clarify this. I mean, this is that complicated. And talked to Sarah herself, which is one of their on-site specialists, a practicing attorney, just brilliant in this stuff, and really quizzed her about this. It was really very helpful. Thank you, Mr. Ed Slott. Now, option three, remain a beneficiary. Why would someone want to do this? Make a what's called a 327 election.
So, yes, the third option, remain a beneficiary. This means that someone would create an inherited account. So this would be what we call a beneficiary IRA. So you want to be treated as a beneficiary. And this is a different path than treating it as your own.
Now, this option, I'm sorry, this option is totally new. This is the brand new part, I would say, of the ruling.
Well, it's definitely makes it more complicated. Mm-hmm. It adds additional rules that weren't there before and different parameters and interpretations. So.
And different options, too. It could be very beneficial to the inheritor of that IRA. Go ahead, Heidi, please.
Okay. So the IRA is considered an inherited account. So this means that the 10% penalty does not apply to distributions prior to 59 and a half. So this goes to one of the items Dennis was talking about. Maybe you don't want it to roll it over into your own IRA because you're under 59 and a half. Maybe you want it to be a beneficiary IRA because beneficiaries do not have that 10% additional tax if you're under 59 and a half.
So the worst happens, let's say you're both 45 years old. Your spouse passes away. You could theoretically inherit their IRA, treat it as a beneficiary IRA, take distributions. You know, you need the income from this, but you want to avoid any penalties. This is the key component of that sort of strategy right there.
Yes, that's a very important strategy and something to definitely think about, especially with younger spouses.
Yes.
All right, so now that you have had option one, two, and three, you even have more choices that you get to make. So we're still talking about option three when you choose to be treated as a beneficiary. So if the person who's the original IRA owner, the spouse that passed away, if they pass away before they start taking required minimum distributions, there are two ways that you can treat that circumstance. So when a surviving spouse decides to keep an account as an inherited account, different rules apply depending on whether the deceased IRA owner died before the deceased owner's required beginning date or the first date that you have to start taking RMDs or on or after the required beginning date. So let's look at the case where the original owner died before the required beginning date. In that case, if the owner dies before, the proposed regulations give two options to a spouse beneficiary who chooses to keep the account as an inherited account. So they can choose to be subject to what we call the 10-year rule, which is where you have to have all the money out before at the end of 10 years, mm-hmm. or they can choose to take RMDs over their life expectancy. Now, if a surviving spouse decides to remain a beneficiary of a deceased spouse, and chooses to take the required minimum distributions, those do not start until the original owner would have turned their RMD age.
Which would typically be, well, today would be age 73. So they die at age 60. You would have the option then to take distributions if you wanted to, or let it continue to grow until that spouse would have been age 73. That's incredible. So you really have some nice options, whether you're a spouse under the age of 59 and a half, you need to take distributions because you need those funds to help you survive and or get through this space, if you will. That's avoiding the 10% penalty. Or if you're older and maybe not need the income, you have some other significant options there of continuing to defer that account if you choose the right option. So sometimes pass and go is a great thing. Sometimes it's not so good.
So it can make, because of these new rules, how old the original IRA owner is, how old the spouse is, how much disparity there is between their ages, all these things come into which choices should I choose? And so Ed Slott was very excited about this. He came up with a new chart. It's called the Spouse Beneficiary Options After Secure 2.0. And it is a complex chart, but it breaks it out between an IRA owner that dies before the required beginning date and those that die after. And so you can, there, it's got about 12 different boxes with all these different choices and different ramifications. So I would just encourage anyone who is a spouse who may be the beneficiary of their spouse's IRA, talk to your financial advisor or come in and see a financial advisor in that circumstance or maybe even before, so that you know what your choices are and you understand the ramifications of different options.
This is so complicated and also offers so many possible benefits that we're already talking about doing a special class on this. Yeah. It's that good. Now, obviously, these are not happy conversations to have. Well, I guess it depends on who the spouse was. We get that. But given that situation, we won't address too closely. But it just is amazing the different options you have and how it could make a significant difference to your own financial well-being, having made the correct choice. Mm-hmm. And honestly, as you were talking, Heidi, I was thinking too, having some kind of recorded interview or program too on our own website about this, because it's that valuable, presents that many opportunities, and also presents that much complexity. So as usual, there are two sides to the coin on this. It can be very complex, but it can also present some really awesome options for those who are inheriting in a difficult situation. All right, question here.
Spouse passed away 2 years ago, didn't have house appraised then. How do I backtrack for cost basis?
Well, 2 years, spouse passed away. I'm not certain why we have to have a cost basis. The spouse, this person was the spouse, your cost basis is what you paid for it with your wife or husband. You don't get an updated cost basis in that situation. Okay.
All right.
Yeah. There may be some other reasons you want to backtrack in answering that question, because if you're thinking of selling it, that's a completely different equation. Your cost basis is generally going to be what you paid for it when you bought it, plus any improvements that you made. But check all of your options with a good accountant, because you may be able to sell it without having to declare any gain because of the house selling rules in regards to, whether it's $250,000 or $500,000 in gain, you get to not declare when selling a primary residence. So there are all kinds of things to think about with this. I would recommend you get, especially if you're going to be liquidating the house, get some independent advice on that. All right. Thanks for the question. Now let's go into these, stats here, Deanne. Jennings,
yes,
thank
we
you.
Found a very interesting article entitled Four AI Bottlenecks Could Bolster Old Economy Companies, and it's from Capital Group. The author is Jared France, and just wanted to give you an overview of this article. The artificial intelligence hype cycle may be coming to an end. Certain resource constraints could prevent AI growth rates from meeting lofty expectations. According to U.S. economist Jared France, one of the ironies of producing an advanced technology like AI is that it requires vast physical resources, and you might not think of such advanced technology as being physically constrained. There's four resource constraints that could slow the growth of AI and present opportunities for old economy companies. Number one, AI sparks a 21st century copper rush. Not a gold rush, but a copper rush. Generative AI tools run on large language models hosted on thousands of servers in massive data centers. Those data centers require cooling systems for the servers as well as power infrastructure. Most of these elements require copper. The construction of a $500 million Microsoft data center near Chicago required 2,177 tons of copper.
That's a lot of copper.
One data center.
Wow.
So data centers constructed over the next 8 years will require 1 million tons of copper in the U.S. alone.
That's radical. Who would have thought this?
I know.
10 years ago when they were talking about the power needs of our United States, none of this was considered. Of course,
it was not
anticipated.
And get this, the demand for copper in electric vehicles, clean energy technology, and the modernization of U.S. electrical grid is also already expected to create growing deficits. The planned construction of AI data centers will push those deficits to more than 6 million tons by 2030, and that's J.P. Morgan.
So we're going to have trouble keeping up with the basic copper needs. So those companies potentially that mine copper are directly involved could be a beneficiary of this demand.
Is that a commodity? Can you invest in copper?
You can. Copper is a commodity. It's obviously very different. I mean, you can find copper coins, pennies, older pennies, but you can get copper in minted state almost, if you will, in terms of actual coins that are made out of copper. Just, I forget what they call them. They're not a typical coin. They're almost like a plug, if you will, of copper.
Okay. So if you wanted to invest in the need of copper down the road, you'd have to find a company maybe that mines or something like that?
Correct. That's directly involved in the copper industry, you bet.
The second resource constraint is power demand is going nuclear. AI, like any advanced technology, needs power, a lot of power. Data centers could consume as much as 9% of total U.S. electricity output by 2030. 9% of total U.S. output. Many tech giants have committed to net zero carbon emissions by 2030. It will be challenging to meet those commitments and power demand. You'll need more wind, a lot more solar, and natural gas.
Nuclear, they have, they call them mini nuclear generators now that some of these big tech firms, I think, are trying to invest in.
Yeah,
private industry. Private industry
will
figure out a way to get this done. We've already heard you. That's a great example right there, Ron. And then also Microsoft is trying to make a deal with a nuclear power plant that was shut down out east somewhere. I forget where that's at. But they're looking to try to bring that back online to use it for their own needs. I mean, we're talking billions of dollars, but to them, they could write a check for that.
Yeah.
The third resource constraint is capital equipment needs are surging. Substantial capital equipment needs to build out data centers and increase power generation globally are driving demand for a range for industrial companies, in some cases leading to shortages. For example, energy equipment maker GE Vernova expects its $6.4 billion backlog of gas turbines needed for backup generators and other electrical equipment triple by the end of 2024. That's the end of 2024.
Yes.
Like the need will triple.
So they're saying to 18 to 19 trillion dollars, a billion dollars rather, sorry, B with a B, billion, in backlog orders.
The fourth restraint is AI needs more humans. New headlines will focus on the potential for AI to eliminate jobs, but the rollout of AI faces a potential human resource shortage. According to recent Salesforce survey, 60% of public sector IT professionals identified a shortage of AI skills as their top challenge in implementing AI. So that's interesting to get it going and started. The bottom line, AI technology has great potential to drive productivity and transform the economy over the long term, but build out and adoption of technology will likely take some time.
Who would have thought the demands on old line technology is only increasing, and it could be akin to an industrial revolution in these United States.
We could see a lot of opportunity.
Absolutely. Yep. I think we already are.
All right, that'll wrap up another edition of New Retirement Radio with Dennis Prout, Heidi Cartwright, and Deanne Jennings of Prout Financial Design in Traverse City, Michigan. Thank you all.
Thanks, Ron.
Thanks, Ron.
Appreciate it.
Thanks, Ron.